Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is September 22nd, 2004. Today's session number is HAC 2004-03. Today's speaker is Cliff Hall. The lesson for today is Health and Wellness for the Over 50, Spirituality and Health. Let's listen in.
The great things about Holden is that we can have intellectual challenges and spiritual challenges and challenges of the putting things together like a basket, and that's pretty impressive. I think this is one of the really wonderful opportunities to enjoy this really fantastic place.
Do you mind if we let the people?
No.
Just wash your hands first.
Well, this is the third session in the health and wellness part of the Elder Hostel program. The first session we talked about health and wellness from a global and national perspective, and I just wanted to, there was a quote that I wanted to bring up in, during that session, and I didn't. It's from Joseph Cardinal Bernardin in the Pastoral Letter on Healthcare in October of '95. We did hit this. This is about whether healthcare is something that should be available for everyone, or whether it's really treated as a commodity, as in a certain extent it is in this country. And he said in that letter, he has subsequently died, but he was one of the great leaders in the Catholic Church. Healthcare is an essential safeguard of human health, human life, and dignity. There is an obligation for society to ensure that every person be able to realize this right. And I think from our discussion, I think it was a general unanimity of opinion that really is what we ought to be working toward, and certainly in this country and then on a global scheme. And I think we should all, one of the things we should commit ourselves to is that we continue to work for that. The fact that we have 46 million of our fellow citizens who don't have any health insurance at all. It's just should not be acceptable in a country as rich as ours. The second session yesterday was about aging and health, and we have a few loose ends, because I feel there's some loose ends from some of the discussion that has occurred afterwards and some of the comments that I've heard. That's, again, one of the really neat things about Elder Hostel, and especially here at Holden Village, where we eat our meals together, and there's so much discussion going on. It's such a great group of people. I learned so much. Successful aging, I think bottom line from that was successful aging was really about adapting to physical change and not so much in trying to maintain ourselves the way we were when we were 20 years old, although that, in some ways that would be great. That's not going to be possible, and I think we all know that. And we really need to adapt to that. And the physical health is just one part of that adaptation. From the Nunn study, just to emphasize those four E's again: education, which clearly is a relationship between longevity and health status with education. That's a lifelong process. All of you are examples of doing that. Exercise, and then enthusiasm and emotions. Positive emotions and enthusiasm toward life are probably some of the most important things that we have. One of the things we didn't spend very much time discussing yesterday and came up in discussion was what about diet? What about diet and things like the Atkins diet and the South Beach diet and all these things that you hear so much about? I think to try to summarize it and get it down to a few important points. Coming out of the Nunn study was some very interesting comments, and Holden sort of epitomizes this as well. It may be more important than what you eat, it's with whom you eat. And that meals, eating all by yourself, gobbling down whatever you're gobbling down. You may have your five vegetables and your three fruits and a very well-balanced diet with lots of colored things that we all know are good for us. But if you're all by yourself, you may have missed out on a very important human part of eating, and that's sharing. And I think when you can share a conversation and share the meal and share some good thoughts, that may actually be more important and may override what you eat. That kind of came out of the nun study, and I think we should think about that in how we should take a little more time with our meals and share those with people we care about.
May I make a comment on that?
You may.
I lost my husband 5 months ago, and I have a candle on my table and in class, and I like, at every mealtime, I light the candle. And his chair is there, and that candle represents my husband. And so I'm in communication with him mentally while I eat, because I don't like to eat alone either.
Marion, that's so beautiful.
And that's what
that
I do.
That is really beautiful.
Yeah, that's what I do. I tell him good morning and goodbye and whatever it is.
No, that's very special.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And then
that's very right brain.
Yes, it is.
In case we didn't know that.
Dog lays by his chair. Interesting.
The dog is good. That's good.
Yeah, the dog.
That's going to come up.
Yes. Pets, the dog is right.
Pets are very important. Pets may be better than husbands.
Don't call
pets.
They don't pay.
Have to be careful, you know.
As far as
diet goes, probably the best scientific evidence that's available right now is the Mediterranean diet. Probably makes the most sense and most helpful. We've gone through these things: polyunsaturated fat, other trans fats, all this other kind of stuff. The Mediterranean diet uses a lot of olive oil, uses a lot of different vegetables and fruits, not a lot of meat. But it doesn't have to be no meat. The evidence on the Atkins and South Beach diet, the really high protein, low carbohydrate diets, is that you can lose more weight more quickly during the first 6 months of an Atkins diet versus a low fat conventional American Heart Association, even a Mediterranean type diet. Your goal is to lose weight. You can lose weight more quickly. The problem with that, and there's a couple problems with that, is that the few long-term studies that are in effect, that weight loss does not persist.
No.
And the weight gradually starts coming back up again. And so that at the end of a year or two, when you compare these studies, all the published studies and all the stuff that you read in Atkins literature is all this first 6 months kind of stuff. And you can show these graphs that you're clearly losing more weight. And there's some favorable lipid changes early on. When you get out longer, it doesn't seem to be anywhere near as effective. So it's probably going to go along with all these other bad diets that have preceded it. Yes?
If you do eat the Atkins diet for the first 6 months, and then if they switch to, like, say, a low-fat diet or something like that, would that help to maintain their weight loss? Or
maintaining weight loss is a really difficult... Anyone that's tried it understands how difficult it is. The body tends to want to reset at a certain level. So there's genetic factors involved. There's the previous lifetime experience of what the diet has been, and change, and what you eat over a lifetime changes your metabolism. There's just no question about that. So that it's not easy. Let's say it's not a good goal. It's probably equally important in terms of losing weight is to take part in some exercise program so that you are being active physically. So that you're in good physical condition, even though you may be carrying more pounds than you want, because that exercise part may override the weight issues. I think a lot of the problems, and especially in these young kids that we're now seeing, the amount of obesity in young children, we're seeing diabetes in 12-year-olds and 14, type 2 diabetes that we used to never see before 40, 50 years old, we're now seeing it in 12 and 14-year-old kids, sometimes even younger. That is a combination of obesity and lack of exercise. It's the lack of exercise that's a key factor. Yeah.
An excellent book is The New American Diet. You've probably heard of it. It's a couple from Portland have written it.
That's right.
They advise, you go through and take tests to see how bad your diet is, but they don't advise you doing anything once. They say, pick one thing and change that one thing. And the whole idea is, if their theory is to change it over a period of years to basically Mediterranean diet, when they end up with low fats
gradually do it.
The idea is to do it gradually, and they're very helpful that way. They have some wonderful recipes.
Yeah.
Really good recipes.
Yeah, I've got that book. Jerry had a comment.
The comment that I had, I did the Atkins diet probably 20 years ago or so, and I lost a huge amount of weight, but the problem came in that before that, I had lived, I mean, I've been raised where we had a lot of vegetables, a lot of salads, a lot, very little fat in the diet. Well, I just got hooked on the original Atkins had nothing. I mean, it was just meat and fried pork rinds, and it was extremely high fat, and I got hooked on that.
Beware of really bad kinds of things. I mean, the old advice, you know, eat a lot of variety, a lot of different kinds of things. Colored food is good. You know, the blueberries and blackberries and oranges and bananas. Oh, try to concentrate more on those nice colors. Ted?
Would you expand a little bit more on this? What you eat over a lifetime changes metabolism. Is that a chemistry thing or?
If you look at, I'll just give it one example, and then we don't really understand, or at least I don't understand, and I don't think many medical researchers understand. What happens, if you look at Southeast Asians, we'll just use those for example, who live in Vietnam or Cambodia and eat a diet that's essentially a vegetarian diet, occasionally have a little chicken or pork, but basically it's a vegetarian diet, a lot of rice, a lot of vegetables, and you look at what their cholesterol levels are, and you'll find that they're extraordinarily low, like a total cholesterol of 85 or 90, something like that. It's very hard for us to even conceive of having our cholesterol that low. But they've been on a diet like that their whole lives. If you take the same, you then transport those people over to this country, especially if they come over as kids, and they eat an American diet, their cholesterol is going to be 200, 220. If you then put them on, you then say, we're going to do an experiment. We're going to take them away from American diet, and we put them on a Southeast Asian diet for just what they would have been eating had they been over there. They can't get their cholesterol anywhere near 100. It just won't do it. If it was 200, they get it down to 180 or 150, 160. It just won't come down, even though they're eating, because something has happened to their bodies, the metabolism, either in the liver or their cells or wherever it takes place, that has changed, induced enzymes, that has made just a difference in metabolism, so that regardless of what they do with their diet, they cannot get it down. And that's why probably if we had grown up in Southeast Asia or Africa or someplace, or just grown up on a diet that's extraordinarily low in fat and we exercise differently or we did things differently throughout our lives, that we would have very low cholesterol levels. And the fact that we have a 200 cholesterol isn't necessarily that's genetically programmed, but that's a combination of your genetics and the environment. So I hope that gives you an idea of the kind of things that happen to us. But it happens to us, I think, about weight. It happens to us about cholesterol levels. It happens to us about a lot of metabolic things in our bodies. It's extraordinarily complicated.
So does that mean that a youngster who was born and raised at Holden Village from two parents with 220 cholesterol would be, if they had grown up here till they were 5 or 6 and they had a cholesterol test, that might be 100?
It probably wouldn't be 100 because we had like ham the other night. and if I know those kids, yeah, I think it would be better. It probably wouldn't be 100, but I think it would be. I think this is a healthy place to grow.
Ice cream sundaes here.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is not exactly a Southeast Asian diet here, but although we did have Thai noodles last night. There are a number. You will find these things everywhere, but I just wanted to go over a couple. The anti-aging plan from Johns Hopkins, and it's all things we've been talking about. Get moving, exercise being important, don't smoke, follow a healthy diet, use supplements wisely, and I would recommend that everyone over the age of 50 take a multivitamin, multi-mineral tablet. It won't hurt you, it will cost you a couple pennies a day, and it may be of some help. We may have micronutrient deficiencies in the foods that we eat. And it is a very simple kind of thing to do. There's pretty good evidence that we want to make sure that we have enough folic acid, B12, things of that sort. And so by taking a...
takes the one from Bi-Mart, so.
Which is
not expensive.
The cheap. You don't have to buy the brand kind that
nationally advertised.
No, it's pretty
good. Costco has one of those.
Too. Yes, that would be the.
What did Gay say?
It's from the one.
Oh, it's a, it's our local Costco.
Local store.
Oh, okay.
Jimmy, in Jimmy Carter's book, in, which is a nice little book, he lists the what he came up with, his summary of things to do. It's don't smoke, maintain a recommended body weight, exercise regularly, minimize consumption of fatty foods, don't drink excessively, never drive when drinking, and that really, we kind of talked about that as well. Fasten your seatbelt, remove handguns from the home. And that really, I think, successful suicides, at least amongst men, are almost always with handguns. And that's, and a lot of homicides, obviously. And he talked about regular checkups. I'm not sure how important those regular checkups are, but I think it is important to have a, if you can, to have a relationship with a primary care doctor.
I'm sorry, could you expand on that regular checkup?
Well, you know, if you, there are some basic recommendations of you know, how can the medical profession help you? And you want, you'd like the medical profession to help you and not hurt you. And every time you go near the medical profession, you run the risk of one of those two things, or the third thing is that, you know, you don't get any benefit, you don't get any harm. But every interchange you have with the medical profession runs a risk of harm. Mm-hmm. And I think just you just have to recognize that every time you get in a car, every time, almost everything you do, that's the way life is. And one has to recognize, I think has to recognize, you have to realize I am a skeptic. I
a
like
heretic, he's a heretic.
No, no, I, as far as medicine goes. And I want to be, I, you know, what I don't want to do is to make it sound like your medicine should, you know, should avoid doctors or avoid healthcare, because there's some absolutely marvelous and wonderful things that medicine can do for you. And clearly, if you have a appendicitis, yeah, I know where you want to be. You want to be in a hospital, you want to get that appendix out. If you're feeling a little blue or down, I'm not sure you necessarily want to, that the doctor is where you want to go. And I'm not sure you want to go for every cold and runny nose and every ache and every pain and every time your ankle hurts, that you necessarily want to get started into the medical system for that. We do a lot of screening. And we create a lot of what's been called proto-diseases. Diseases. We're really good at relieving symptoms and taking care of acute crises. Get run over by a truck, get shot. Boy, no better place to be than at a major medical center. But we have created. So I bet everybody here has a disease, or at least if you don't have it, if you don't know it, I bet if we do enough tests, we can find it. you know, I mean, I'm going to sound sacrilegious here, because the chiropractors can always find something out of line in your back so that you need some treatments. Doctors of conventional medicine can always find something wrong with you that you're going to need some kind of ongoing treatment or monitoring or follow-up or visits or another test or something. And so we create people who feel they're perfectly healthy have disease, proto-diseases, hypertension. Don't get me wrong, hypertension is a killer, or is a potential killer, and needs to be treated, needs to be taken care of. But when 30 or 40% of the population, or by the time you get to be 70 years old, it's about 60, 65% of the population has high blood pressure. Now we've created, all those people are patients. They're not just healthy people, they're patients. They have conditions, but then now we've labeled them with a disease. And is it really a disease? It's a condition, it's a risk factor. You know, just like not hooking your seatbelt. But that's not a disease if you don't hook your seatbelt. I don't think it's a disease. It's maybe right brain.
No, it's not a disease.
So we label everybody with you know, you're a hypercholesterolemic, and you're a hypertensive, and you're somebody with an elevated PSA level, and you're someone, and you're a woman, so you need the mammograms and things. You know, so there's just a lot of things going on. And there's probably a relatively small number of things that are really going to have a major impact on your life. In life expectancy.
So if a lot of us, just to use that example, are going to have hypertension, we already do, and it's not something to be rushing in about, what should we do?
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I think it needs...
there's a balance. I think high blood pressure is important. I think it needs to be treated. I think there are many ways of treating high blood pressure, losing weight, exercise, right off the bat, reducing salt in your diet. So there's a number of non-pharmacologic things, and then there are medications that are very effective. There are some medicines that are much more effective than others. They need to be used. They need to be used judiciously. What I just see a lot of people, their whole life seems to be focused on their, on from a disease point of view on their bodies, as opposed to living their life. And you just need, I'm just asking for some balance. And I suspect this group right here is a very well-balanced group, but that not everyone is that way. There's a tendency in the medical profession to encourage labeling of people as having diseases. And that creates a lot of anxiety. We talked about PSA testing a little bit yesterday. That's created so much anxiety in this country, well beyond what the threat of prostate cancer.
I'm sure glad you talked about that, because I have, there's so much advertising now about when we're getting
it. There's a tremendous fear amongst women about breast cancer, huge amount of fear and concern. Like, this is a lurking danger that's ready to strike them at any time, just out of the blue kind of thing. And it's true, a number of women are going to die of breast cancer, going to get breast cancer and require surgery, and going to have problems with that. But on a statistical basis, especially younger women have very low risk of breast cancer, yet there's a great fear. If you talk to a 35 or 40-year-old woman, ask her what's the thing she fears most she's going to die from, it's going to be breast cancer. And what's the chance of her dying in the next 5 years of breast cancer? It's almost zero. What's the most likely thing she's going to die from? She's much more likely to be killed in a motor vehicle accident. More likely to be killed homicide or suicide. And people just don't always put things into the kind of perspective that they need to put. That was my own. I didn't really want to get way off into that.
I have a question. How do you counter people who are anti-doctors and say they're all quacks and I'm not going to go to them? And they say, if you go to this doctor, you're going to get in trouble because he had this bad experience with another patient. How do you counteract that kind of...
You don't. It's belief. You can talk to somebody who firmly believes in one religion or another religion that you think even are politics. There are certain things you just can't change people's mind on. I mean, it's not rational. It's not, it's something down deep inside. They feel that all doctors are quacks. There's nothing you're going to be able to tell them that's going to change their mind.
Well, they're trying to talk me out of going to one doctor. And my point is, first place, I know him and he knows my problems. And any place else, they would go to Seattle. Well, how am I going to get to Seattle? That's 100 miles away. I couldn't drive it. So I want somebody in my local community that I know and he knows me. And that's the way I call them.
That I think makes excellent sense, and you're doing the right thing. Just a couple things about, if I can find it here, other ways of things that reduce risk. Taking a nap. There's actually medical evidence in a Greek study. If you take a 30-minute nap every day, you reduce your risk of having a heart attack by 30%.
Whoa!
If you take a 60-minute nap, it reduces it by 50%. The Greeks all take naps, as I'm sure you know. But if you sleep longer than 60%, it starts to decline again. So 60 minutes, set the alarm clock, 60 minutes, wake up, that'll be fine. For individuals who've had a heart attack, if they have a pet at home, a pet they like. If you have a pet you don't like, I don't know what the thing is, but if you have a pet, in one study, there was an 80% reduction in recurrent myocardial infarction. I mean, that is just, it's kind of hard to believe, and I don't really necessarily believe those numbers, but I think it's probably true that there really is a reduction. If you're married or have a life partner, by all criteria of health, you are better off than if you have always been single, or if you've been through a divorce. A divorce is the worst category to be in, being widowed is not as bad as having been through a divorce. This is something I know you're going to be really interested in. There was a British study about sex. This only applied to men.
Is that man with men?
And so, draw whatever conclusions you want.
How did that work?
I think they only study men, but I don't really know what the situation is. But amongst British men, if you had sex twice a week, you had a 50% reduction in all-cause mortality as compared to men who had sex only once a month or less, or had less than once a month. So deal with that as you may. That study came out, and that was published in a prestigious journal, a British journal, I think it was indeed the Lancet, the British Medical Journal. There was a cartoon, there was this great cartoon, and I probably should have brought this cartoon for you so you have a little more levity. But there was this guy, he's in bed with his wife, and his wife is, you know, she's got the pillow over her head, and she's turned the other way, and he's reading this newspaper, says, you know, sex, live longer with sex, or whatever it is. And he's looking at her, and he's saying, "You're killing me."
What were those times again? Twice a week.
What a nerd.
Live longer. Yeah, so how does
it? Yeah. We didn't say sex had to be with anybody else. you know, and I'm not saying that facetiously. I'm recognizing that we as human beings are sexual creatures, and that is part of our existence, part of our life. So, and I think we shouldn't try to deny it. I really don't know nuns well, and I don't know really what they're saying. So I can't speak to that. But it may be that there are other factors that clearly, this is not the only factor in life.
Vacuum into a cork. Would you want to talk about
something? Time out. One last comment is that connections with nature seem to be very important. Gardeners, gardening is a tends to lower mortality rates. And it was one study in which if you're in a hospital, if you have a choice, get the room near the window and try to get into a ward that actually has a nice view of hillsides or something green or a tree or something like that, because recovery from surgery was actually quicker in those individuals who had hospital rooms that actually looked out at something green.
I have a...
Green rocks.
Green rocks.
Any geology.
Tacoma General in Tacoma just built a new operating room that overlooks the sound, and I was talking to the surgeon that works in there, and he'd operated in there for the first time, and he was saying the difference in what happened with his staff and everybody in that room just being there.
Years ago, I had surgery, and my room looked out over another green area, but it was a cemetery.
They brought dogs in for us to play with, at least a couple of times.
I think that's that pet therapy. Wow. I think that's really
great.
Really
successful.
That's why we should paint our gravel green in Arizona.
Yeah, we had that discussion at one of the sessions here about painting rocks green. Apparently, in some places they do.
In some city, they paint their yards. Well, they put rocks down because it's desert.
Any other question about longevity and physical things before we move into the discussion about faith and spirituality and medicine? Yes.
I'd just like to make one comment, Cliff. For me, the change from growing up to now with medical field has been that I need to be confronted with it. I need to be in charge of my own life. And as growing up, I think I just, and even into early adult, middle adult, my perception, unconscious perception of a doctor was that he knew exactly what was the best for me, and that was it, and I just took it, and I did with it. But I'm finding that it's very important for me to be in charge of what happens between me and that doctor. And I find that that is a change I've had to adapt to, mm-hmm. and really recognize and do something about, because he may not know what's best for me, mm-hmm. or she may not know what's best for me.
You are absolutely right, and that's very well spoken. And I think that is the thesis of Newland's book that I give. I mean, you might think I'm getting a cut on every book that I've sold here, because I think it is such a good book, and that is the underlying thesis that runs through this book, is that you really have to take care of yourself. You have to recognize what the issues you are and what your values are and what you want out of life and what you expect. In fact, one of the things I will do it. I wasn't going to do it. I wanted to get into this faith on medicine, but at one of the previous elder hostels, somebody said, well, what makes a good patient? What makes a good patient? And so I got me thinking about that, and I wrote down five things that if you want to be a good patient, this is what you have to do. One is to prepare for your visit with your physician. What do you want and expect? Do you want questions answered? Do you want relief of symptoms? Do you have worrisome concerns? Do you want preventive services? And you think about that before you go in. I mean, why are you going there? So that you don't go in there with one expectation and you don't make that clear to your physician. So if you want some, if you're worried about something, you're just worried about something, you know, whatever it is, then make sure you make that very clear to the physician that you're worried about. If you've got pain and you want pain relief, then you really don't care. It doesn't matter. You're pretty sure it's arthritis. You just want something for it. Then make that that clear. Prepare a medical history. Always have your medical history, which includes surgeries, major illnesses, immunizations, habits, smoking, drinking, whatever, family history, so that you could have that and actually have a sheet. And if there's some question about it, you can hand it to them. Frequently, physicians are going to have you fill out those things. Always carry a list of medicines and medications and allergies with you. Everybody should have in their wallet or the purse what their current medicines are, what allergies they have. That should always be with you. And then make a specific list of what you want to discuss with your physician. I've had patients come in with 30 things. And the only thing I can say is, you know, what's number one? Because what they usually do, if you start on the list, you get down, you discuss 8 or 10 of them, and then you're shaking hands, goodbye, and then you say, but what I'm really here for, doctor. Don't do that. I mean, that is just not a good thing to do. If you have one main thing you want, make sure you deal with that. And start off with the most important ones. And the other piece of advice is, in the same way you want your physician to get to know you, get to know something about your doctor. Mm-hmm. It's perfectly okay to ask a question about, you know, where'd you grow up? You have family, you have the kids, and over a period of time, you're gonna, some of the most wonderful experiences I have had are to walk into an exam room and to have my patients ask me about what my son is doing, or, you know, how was that trip that you took, you know, a couple weeks ago to someplace, and that, because they've had an interest in you as well, and that just cements a relationship. It's not all one way. So I think that's really important that you make, if you're going to have an onboarding, that's not the case where you're going in to have your gallbladder taken out and you've been referred to surgery. I mean, you don't care what it, you know, what his kids are doing. And he didn't care what your kids are doing. No. He just wants to get that gallbladder out. And that's perfectly fine. You don't need a wonderful, warm relationship with your surgeon. Yeah, and by and large, you won't get one. Kermit, do you have a comment?
Have you addressed the 60 milligrams of aspirin a day?
I didn't, but that's a...
Is that the right amount, 60, 70 milligrams?
Aspirin comes in 81 milligrams. The smallest one you can buy is 81 milligrams of therapeutic aspirin. It's a quarter.
I cut it in half.
And you can cut it in half. That's perfectly fine.
Is it advisable to do that?
Probably the majority... It, yeah, I think for the majority of people over 50 or 60, probably a half an aspirin or a quarter of an aspirin tablet a day is probably beneficial. You hate to say generally. I think that's something you probably ought to discuss with your physician if there are contraindications. If you had ulcer disease in the past, if you have bleeding tendencies, if you're allergic to aspirin, obviously it's not the right thing. But for the majority, the net benefit is probably greater. Your reduction in overall incidence of strokes and a reduction in heart attack. You know, the old say, as somebody calls the doctor in the middle of the night, I'm having chest pain, take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. That reduced the mortality rate from myocardial infarction by 50%. Aspirin is the best treatment we have for a heart attack. Now, we can take it down from 50%, and we can give other medications, and we can get it down so that the average rate of death from myocardial infarction now is around 6 or 7% in the hospital. Which
is the aspirin true for both men and women?
Yes, it is. Most of the studies have been through men, just like the sex studies.
Stop thinking when you go to the dentist.
Right. Let's move on into, I took a little more time than I really wanted to there, but let's talk about faith and medicine. And I think it's a subject that's especially relevant here at Holden Village, and it's something that's important to all of us as we've tried to look at our spiritual sides as well as our physical sides. And we've been concentrating really on our, up until now, on our physical health. And the question is, does faith influence our physical health, and does it influence our longevity or our response to disease and overall health status? I think anyone who we're all spiritual beings, in the same way we're sexual beings or we're physical beings. There's a historical relationship, of course, between medicine and religion, and historically the healer was almost always the religious person in the tribe or in the previous culture. The priest and the physician were essentially one and the same for years and years. And it wasn't until late 1700s and into the 1800s that really became a separation, where we separated the physical from the spiritual. And to a large extent, it was a reflection of the success of the scientific approach to medicine. Up until that time, when someone got sick or got ill, the questions that were asked by that individual were not so much, what's going on in my liver, or why are the blood vessels in the heart narrowing, or whatever, from the pathophysiologic view that we currently have. It was rather, what's happening to me? You know, explain what's going on. What's going to happen to me? Can you predict what the future is going to be? And what can be done to improve this in response? And that was the need to create a better future. And all those things are kind of existential questions that were really more suited to be answered, not by someone dealing with the physical, but rather the more spiritual side of why we're here and what we're doing. There's also, I brought this up at the other night, there is an analogy between the ancient temples or even the cathedrals and the current medical center. If you think about it, if you think of your communities, I know in my community, sitting on the hill is the hospital. I mean, it's the big, beautiful edifice you compare that to the cathedrals in Europe, or the Mayan temples that dominated the landscape. That's right now, we kind of look at the medical center, they're dominating. It's a dominant architecture. Think of the priests and think of your surgeons, each one wearing special kinds of robes. Very, very specific dress. Think of who can get into the inner chambers of the cathedral or into the operating room. You just can't go walk into the operating room, nor could you if you were a Mayan peasant walk into where the priests were carrying out their activities. They wore their robes, they did sacrifices and looked at the organs and predicted the future. We take you into the operating room, we open you up, we don't exactly sacrifice you, but we look at the organs and we predict the future. It's just a tremendous analogy. It's almost eerie to think about it, and how much of what we see in medicine almost carries a spiritual component to it. I mean, it really is and as you brought up, you thought years ago, you thought physicians knew everything. that they really were able, they would kind of had answers to everything and did the right thing, and certainly people felt that way about their religious leaders in years gone past. What I'd like to do is to talk about two parts about how faith and medicine kind of interact. The first part, dealing with whether religious involvement and spirituality really does have an impact on health status, longevity. And the second would be something a little considerably more difficult, difficult to even conceive of, and certainly difficult to test or to analyze, and that is whether intercessory prayer has an influence on someone. So if you have a loved one who is ill and you pray for that person, is that person going to do better? If you get a whole lot of people praying for that person, is that person going to do better? That's a difficult issue. It's a difficult issue to even conceive of in some way. Are we really testing God? How arrogant can you be to think that, you know, we can organize a little group and somehow influence if God has any influence on the day-to-day events here, that we could somehow convince him to do something for someone or not for someone else, and if they didn't already know that was the right thing to do. It's kind of difficult questions for me anyway. Maybe they're easier in a different framework. We talked about the historical relationship of healing and religion. I'd like to make a distinction between being religious and being spiritual, and I think everyone here knows that there is a significant difference it is much easier from a scientific point of view to get a handle on being religious than it is on being spiritual, because we can use criteria like how often do you go to church, do you belong to an organized religion that has a set common values. Religion, the word religion comes from religare, I guess everybody knows that. It's a Latin word, it means to bind together, so it binds together a group of beliefs and opinions and principles and organizes it into a set series. Spirituality comes from the Latin word spiritualitas, which means breath or to breathe. And it's obviously a different thing from binding a group together. It's a broader concept, relates to connectedness to others, to nature, transcendence, and values, love and integrity, compassion, justice, things of that sort. So spirituality is very different from being religious. They're obviously interrelated, but it's very hard to get a handle on whether someone's spiritual. Much easier to find out whether they're religious and they go to church, or they say, yes, I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Lutheran, or I'm a Muslim, or I follow the
Hindu. May I add that spirituality is on the right side of the brain, and it has no words.
And I think that's, and it's
that's
and,
what we talked about yesterday.
And I think you're absolutely right. The majority of people in this country, more than 90% believe in a higher being, and 94% in surveys state that they believe that spiritual health is as important to them as physical health. And the majority of, by far the majority of people believe that spirituality does impact and improve their physical status. Well, do we have find that the majority of people believe that? Is there any evidence to support that? And the answer is there is. And it relates to mortality, to cardiovascular disease, to hypertension, and to end-of-life issues, and to mental health issues. So there's a lot of evidence. Most of it is fairly good. Some of it can be questioned on issues. But there are 18 studies in the literature about mortality. Religiously involved people live longer. And that's the conclusion. One 28-year study of 5,000 adults aged 21 to 65 those that attended religious services once a week or more, they had a 23% less likely chance of dying than people who didn't attend religious services. It's about the same as having sex. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done that. I've been serious here, you know. That's my right thing.
Okay, so is Saturday night sex and Sunday morning? Sure.
Boy, you know, you're just, you'll live forever. I do it, Paul. This gets gay, just can't stand it. Because I do this, you know, and I shouldn't. There was another 5-year study, I'm just picking out a couple of these studies, about 2,000 adults over the age of 55, those that attended church on a regular basis, 24% reduction in mortality. Another one of 4,000 adults over 65, a 28% reduction in mortality. So it's, you know, it obviously you don't live forever, but there seems to be something about attending religious services or belonging to a religious group that is beneficial. Looking at cardiovascular disease, they looked at, they compared us in a Jewish study, this, so this doesn't necessarily just apply to Christian or in a Jewish group, but a secular Jewish, there was a versus Orthodox Jews. The Orthodox Jews had a 25% reduction risk of heart attack. The women had even a greater reduction in the risk of heart attacks, the Orthodox Jewish women.
Is there a diet involved in that?
There may be. And most of these studies have tried to correct for some of the confounding variables, and we'll get into that. If you look at smokers, people who attend church tend to be lower smokers. They tend to have a number of other health habits that are more favorable. They tend to more likely be married. So there's a whole bunch of things that that you're selecting out. And if you look at Seventh-day Adventists or Mormons, for example, you know, don't drink, don't smoke. So that group, if you were just looking at them, they clearly do better than a group of non-Mormons or non-Seventh-day Adventists in terms of mortality rates. But that can be clearly related to health habits. When you eliminate those things, you still are left with this 10 to 20% change. They did a big study of 10,000 Israeli civil servants, those that were Orthodox Jews versus those that were non-religious, 20% reduction in coronary artery disease. Not every study, out of 16 studies that were looked at in this particular review, 12 showed a reduction, 4 showed no difference. So again, it's not 100% in every single study. Hypertension, similar kind of thing. There's other studies that have demonstrated, just as you were pointing out, that there are other factors that may be involved in this. Religious activity is associated with more exercise, it's associated with better nutrition and dietary patterns, it's associated with a higher incidence of seatbelt use. So people who go to church versus those who don't go to church use their seatbelts more. Is that a surprise? Is anybody surprised at that, or do you sort of predict that?
Who did this study that you're referring to?
I'm sorry?
Who did this study that you're referring to?
I can get you the reference if you really want it. But the data I think are good. I think the data are good. I mean, they're obviously, I'm sure it's based on questionnaire data, but I suspect it's reasonable.
Not why would they apply?
They have a lower incidence of smoking, and they have a greater use of preventive services. To me, it doesn't surprise me at all.
They follow the rules.
Because they follow the rules.
They follow the rules.
I think that's exactly right. And they also tend to accept authority more than the individuals that don't accept authority. So if somebody tells them they ought to go get a mammogram every year, and somebody tells them they ought to stop smoking, wear a seatbelt, do these things, they're more likely to do that. And those are all good things. And those are all good things. The difficult issue is it really belonging to the church and being religious? Does that have, in addition to all these other good things, is it helpful? Mental health, depression, anxiety, substance abuse, all of those are inversely associated with religious activity. So you have less depression, less anxiety, less substance abuse.
did you say something about religious people being more connected with exercise?
Yeah, they do.
What would be that connection, I wonder? I don't disagree, I'm just curious.
I don't have a precise explanation, but I think it's part of the thoughts that were suggested about the willing to follow advice.
Maybe
a little bit more.
I see.
It may also be taking care of the temple of
right. Now that's what I was thinking.
Okay.
Yes. Going to church gets you out and about, and you're more likely to continue to be out and about than sedentary people.
Okay.
And that would be speak to the exercise.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And if it does give you a sense of purpose in life too, that there's something more than just the day-to-day existence. There's something beyond that. Suicide is certainly another area, and there's a clear-cut inverse relationship between religious activity and suicide. It was first reported in medical literature in 1897. Was the first report of that. Belief in God, attendance with religious activity, self-reported religiosity, and religious upbringing, all of those are associated with a lower risk of suicide. And that's probably not surprising, since most religions consider suicide to be a negative thing.
But not all of them.
Not all. And dying for one's... I mean, one can look at the way the Christians responded to the Roman, being put in with the lions and things, that they, as almost a form of suicide to a certain extent, since they may not have a lot to resist that, but they, from what I understand, there wasn't a lot of resistance because it was felt that this was, they were being sacrificed, but they were being sacrificed in a way that was going to give them everlasting salvation. So one can look at this a little bit different, and certainly what we see with suicide bombers who believe what they're doing is in the interest of religion in some way, some twisted way.
They go to heaven with nine virgins.
There are indices of something called health-related quality of life, and in. If you have religious activity, your health-related quality of life, this is how you view how healthy you are. In patients with cancer, AIDS, coronary artery disease, limb amputation, and spinal cord injury, in all of those situations, people who are religious feel that they are doing better than those that don't have it. So it really helps people to cope with the illnesses that they have. I mean, we talked about adaptation earlier and what aging is. And so, although I see that aging is not listed there, it pops to mind that maybe individuals who are religious adapt to aging better. What we are not able to get a handle on is this issue of spirituality. Pretty easy to find out if you go to church, or you might lie about when you go to church, or you might overestimate how frequently you go. But it's very hard to know whether someone is spiritual and feels and expresses those values of love, the connectedness with nature, with other individuals, sort of a transcendence that there's more to life than just the day-to-day existence. And it's very hard to get a handle on that. So it may very well be that individuals who feel, who are not religious, but who are connected to nature, say, in some way, that really feel the life cycles of the leaves falling off the trees and can relate to that, may very well have all the benefits of what what going to church every week does. It's just very hard to do that kind of research. So how do we explain what we do find? We've sort of hit some of those things. Religious people tend to embrace healthy habits. There's a lot of social support, and that's a real, came out in the Nun study, that comes out in other things, of being able to be part of a group of people who you care about and they care about and you have common interests. So I think that may play an important role. We talked about the importance of emotions, and certainly religious activity tends to promote very positive emotions in terms of hope and love, forgiveness, contentment, all those kinds of things that are So much of present. I mean, I was just thinking of the service last night when we were talking about war and people dying, and at the same time having the hope and asking for forgiveness and asking. Those are very such positive things that you can't help but have some good feelings that come out of that. That lowers norepinephrine levels in your body. You don't want to have high norepinephrine. Lowers the stress hormones. So all those. So when you feel those emotional things, it's doing some very positive things physiologically inside. And those have to be good. And there seems to be a response on the immune function as well. The same kind of emotion, but again, it's probably mediated by norepinephrine, which is the stress hormones and adrenaline. Well, those are all the positive effects. Are there some potential negative effects of being religious? There probably are. One of the things that I'm sure you know, that there are certain religions that forbid certain medical activities. Jehovah Witness come to mind immediately about blood transfusions. And you think of a young child being in a motor vehicle accident, having a ruptured spleen, having a major hemorrhage. And on a religious belief, that child, the parents would, at least in some occasions, would feel that it would be better that the child die than they receive a blood transfusion. That would be a very, from a health point of view, that's obviously a very negative, looking at it from the physical body point of view. One can understand how someone might believe that. The state will step in. So if you're an adult, you can do anything. You can refuse any kind of treatment. You can do anything you want, pretty much. But if you're an adult who's responsible for a child, the state feels that it has an interest in the well-being, the physical well-being of that child. And the state will almost always step in. And in fact, in an emergency room situation like that, one can get, with a simple telephone call to the local judge, can get an order to just go ahead and treat the child, regardless of what the family is saying. And it's pretty much standard. That's a standard of practice. Now, you would try to, if you're in an emergency room setting, you would try very hard to see if you couldn't treat that child without a blood transfusion safely. But if it was a matter of true life and death for that child, or increased risk of morbidity or brain damage, then by all means, one would just go ahead and give the blood transfusions, get the court order supporting that. And families cannot sue, and in a situation like that, they yes. cannot sue for doing things against the will. At least that's the case in Oregon. I think that's the case pretty much in any state in the union. Yes?
Have there been any studies on the follow-ups of these family situations after the child has had treatment over the parents' wishes?
I know of some anecdotal things where it depends on how strong the faith is. Some people apparently have felt that everything that was okay, and that especially since they didn't have control over it,
yeah, right.
It was you took the control away from them. You know, the state did it, so therefore there's no guilt associated with it. But there have been some cases where the child has almost been shunned because they feel this child is damned or everlasting. And there's no way, and apparently there's no way, I don't know, I don't know enough about this, but if you believe, the way they believe that once that horrible sin has been committed, there's no way to reverse that, at least not on this earth, where there's something in the everlasting that can ultimately give forgiveness. But that's a very negative thing, and living with that, the sense that you've done something very, very bad and you can't make amends for it is obviously not good for your health. And in fact, there was a study that said, pointed out that people who have religious struggle associated with illness, if they're angry at God, if they feel they're being punished by God, if the illness is a form of punishment, you know, I got cancer or I got a heart attack because I did something bad and God is now punishing me for this, or if they think the devil and... something like 65 or 70% of Americans believe that the devil exists. But if the devil caused this disease, because the devil's going around doing bad things, then those people have between a 10 and 28% increase in mortality over 2 years. So having religious beliefs can have a real downside. We were talking about all the upside, but if there's religious struggle involved, and it's a huge sense of guilt, I was brought up Catholic, and one of the nice things about the Catholic Church is that, you know, you can get rid of your guilt like that. and that's good. I mean, that is a very good thing, because what we don't want to carry, I mean, we'd like to lead our lives well, but one of the things you don't want to carry around is a lot of guilt. Anyway, are there other situations in some of the fundamentalist groups? Child abuse does occur. There's beatings. We've had a couple cases in Oregon that I'm aware of where children were beaten because they thought they were possessed of the devil or something like this, and they were beaten severely. Obviously, that's not in anyone's interest. Yeah.
Well, on a much milder plane, children are not allowed, school children are not allowed to participate in festivals that other, sometimes, you know, so they're ostracized by their schoolmates because they can't be part of the festival.
Yes, anything patriotic.
Christmas, yeah.
Or religious.
Yeah, and Halloween and Valentine's, those things they can't.
Yes, I taught in a community that was had a good percentage of the community with Jehovah's Witness. And
with what?
Jehovah's Witness. And I spent a lot of time with them and working with them. And a lot of the understanding that I got were many of the converts that came in had a whole different philosophy than those that had been raised. And I mean, there was the not participating in this, but I found that working with them, they had a better attitude and they understood and they could explain to the child what was going on. Whereas the new recruits that would come in had a tendency to spank the child if they did something that shouldn't be, rather than discussing it. But I got a new, I mean, I don't believe in the Jehovah's Witness, but I got a new understanding of it. And so my thought is that they probably, some of the leaders of the church, probably would be the ones that would have accepted someone taking it out of their hands. It's just my standpoint.
It probably points out that so much of the misunderstanding of the world is that we don't have these close contacts with people. You know, that somehow, so they become separated, right, and we stereotype. Yes. Beliefs, you know, I mean, and, you know, I mean, it's like how many of us have good, close Muslim friends and really understand the Muslim religion from on a personal point of view. You know, we can read about it, we can hear about it, we can get a lot of things, but it's until we've lived in a Muslim community or have had close contact with that, I don't think we can really understand that in the same way with your comments.
Well, the head just kind of came, I got in one real conflict with a parent. And I said, well, how come you decided to be a Jehovah's Witness? And she said to me, have you ever known that something existed that you believed in from a child, a religion? That, and she said, can you identify with that? And I said, yes. So, I mean, it when you belong to a religion that is not the mainstream, and it is your belief, I can understand. Not that I agree with that.
Other potential negative kinds of things in some of the fundamentalist Mormon groups, there's widespread polygamy, which really is a form of child abuse of the young girls.
Still today?
Still today, yes. In large scale, in certain communities, and no real effort being made whatsoever by authorities to really crack down on that.
There's a group between Arizona and Nevada.
Utah.
That they just kind of go back and forth across the line. So when the authorities in one state get on them, they go across the line.
And there's John Krakauer has written a book called Under the Banner of Heaven. Has anyone read that book? Strongly recommend that book if you want to get an insight into, again, don't paint the broad brush for the Mormons altogether, but these are sects of very, very right-wing fundamentalist groups that practice things that are very similar. It's like having the Taliban next door. It really is. And what their relationship to their girls and their families and the women and their families is very, very similar, remarkably similar to the beliefs of some very fundamentalist Islamic groups that we would say that we would not think of all as being compatible with our Western way of life. I think it's so there, we have a relatively good body of evidence that suggests that if you do have religious activity in your life, that there are some definite benefits. There's obviously some potential downside with religious beliefs, and we didn't get into the Muslim fundamentalist attitude toward Western society and what our society represents to them and what that leads to. Then get into the Crusades. The war last night, I sat there last night and thought from an article I read on the way up here from a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force who had lost his son in Iraq, his comments to the Oregonian were that non-Christians could not understand the real reason why we're fighting over there, and that this is really a religious war. This is a fundamentalist Christian war against a fundamentalist Muslim war, and that oil is just an incidental part of it, and of a lot of other little reasons, and I don't know if that's true, and I hope it isn't. But if that's even playing part of the role, then that's clearly a downside of his religious activity leading to death and destruction and war. And so, and to the extent that religion's been involved in wars, religion has to take responsibility for that. Has to at least share in the responsibility for some of the destruction and suffering that has occurred.
Yeah, I'm beginning to get into it seems to me our spiritual views have a whole lot to do with our end of life issues.
They do.
I mean, the kind of treatment we want, or how we want our life extended at any cost.
The next two sessions, we're going to concentrate with. Tomorrow, we're going to kind of hit on some just sort of a background and structure for how we look at medical ethics and how we make ethical decisions. What kind of principles we use, the competing goods. That autonomy is a good, but so is social justice, and how do these things interact? And we'll talk a little bit about things like therapeutic cloning for stem cell research and stuff, because that's an important issue, I think, that's come up. And then get into this whole issue about end-of-life concerns, how we make decisions in terms of what we want and we get to the end of life. So we've got a couple hours that we will kind of explore those things. Any other comments about spirituality, religious experience, and health effects before we get into a little bit about intercessory prayer?
What about resistance to immunization of the children?
Very excellent, and I actually had it there. I have it right down there, right to childhood immunizations. Absolutely, that is a serious. Well, we have several groups of people that don't get their kids immunized, and we kind of brought that up briefly before. But there are some religious groups that feel very strongly about that. Christian Science, for example, and there's a certain irony in a lot of this, and we'll get into this tomorrow or the next day. 40, 50 years ago, it was the Christian Scientists and some of the Jehovah's Witness groups, the religious groups were after the medical profession, the legal profession, that they had a right to refuse treatment. We now have religious groups represented by George Bush, yes, especially his brother in Florida, who are using religious reasons to force treatment on people. In which you can't take out that feeding tube out of Terry's scribble.
Yes.
Down near Terry's Law. A law that applies only to one person. It's to me, there's an irony in that. But anyway, that's another issue, and we will get into that.
Yes.
But you make a good point at what point does society say immunization is important? Because herd immunity is what really protects all of us. It isn't any individual, it's when we can, and if we get, if because we don't pay for immunizations for poor kids, for some of the poor kids, and if there are some religious groups that don't want to get immunized, and then there's just, then it's a group of well-educated people who are very cynical about everything's going on, you know, your fillings are causing multiple sclerosis, and the, you know, medical fed is a big, you know, it's a big conspiracy out there to create illness, and immunizations are one of those. Then we get, and so now we're eating away at the herd immunity, and more in the herd are going to be susceptible to disease, and that's going to make all of us more susceptible. So yeah, that is a problem. Yeah. You have a question?
No.
I mean, isn't it the whole, I'm an individual on my own, and people are no longer thinking of the social good, the common good. They're not, I have these rights, period, for me. I think that plays into the whole.
That may be a reflection of this, of where the society's gone in the past 15, mm-hmm. 20 years. I think there has been a movement to greater emphasis of the individual versus our fellow citizens, and I think we talked about the inequities in income and wealth as being a major contributor to lower health status amongst part of the population. And the more you get that inequities, the worse the lower group is going to be, and that's, I think that's all harmful. Yes.
The immunization. Most states have requirements for schooling.
They do, but
you can sign an exception.
Yeah, there's ways of the ways around it, and
well,
not all.
Where I was in Minneapolis, where I taught, they didn't come in the door until they were immunized.
Yeah, well that well, you know, and I think there are communities in which the immunization rates really are up in the 90%. But the United States, when you look at gross statistics for the United States, Cuba is way ahead of us. Almost all the Central American countries are ahead of us in immunization rate. You had your question or comment? Yeah.
Yes, I was wondering, have you come across any studies that would contrast religions that you might say are rigid, inflexible, kind of on that side of the scale versus those that are more open, gracious, loving oriented, and the impact on health issues?
Boy, that's an interesting. No, I have the answer. I have not, and I haven't seen them do that. But I think that's a fascinating. That would be a fascinating study for someone to look at, and it might give a handle. I bet you find health behaviors are very different in those two groups. As one thing, you know. So you have to control for that. I imagine that the rigid group, if you felt comfortable in a very rigid group, you really probably hook that seatbelt every single time. And you know, you really follow the rules, whereas in more loving, but you would get the benefits of the loving, caring community, and not the fear or the guilt or the other kinds of things that drives the other group. It'd be very. You should do the study. In Chico,
I'll need your help.
any other comments about that, or personal experience, or is there anything that we said today that said, boy, that doesn't sound right, or that just...
Well, the thing I would say up here I think you mentioned it a little bit on spiritual practices, that it's very hard to both gauge and have a real study on. Being from the Native American background and going back into my Native spiritual practices, we are in different levels than other religious backgrounds than the quote Christian European religious study area, and we're on different levels than other people's religious practices. And I think the comment about nature and hospitals having a view of nature, or water, or trees and plants is a retrospect of our part of our Native background too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment about the Christian Scientists, because we have personal relationships with several people in Christian Sciences, religion, and I have never seen anyone so positive in their outlook mm-hmm. on life. And I wondered if there was a study, there probably hasn't been a study of that group specifically as to longevity and that kind of thing.
I bet they have been, but I'm just not aware of that.
They don't speak, and which is really a good thing. You see, they don't really speak of illnesses. So, and they walk away from you if you start to tell them all about your aches and pains. And in one way, that really is good, because some seniors get into the habit of doing nothing but talking about how bad they feel. And they go under the idea that, and I really believe it, that, you know, what comes out of your mouth and what you think and dwell upon is what happens to you. So to speak constantly of illnesses is just really saying, you're going to be ill.
Well, you know, I think that's a good point, and I think that's been kind of a theme in some of our discussions here, too. At least I hope that...
Well, they have a practitioner, too, who has healing practices.
Well, let's move on in the remaining time here to talk a little bit about intercessory prayer, and this is a much more difficult topic, as you can imagine. It's been looked at for a long time in the scientific literature. Sir Francis Galton looked at it in the 1800s. Yes,
define what you're talking about, intercessory prayer.
Intercessory prayer is the situation in which the health of an individual can be affected by someone who prays for that individual. It would involve some kind of power or some kind of communication or something that doesn't take place along any physical laws as we understand them. So in other words, we're not touching the person, we're not giving the person food or nourishment or drugs or anything of that sort, but somehow that an activity that takes place over here can affect something that's over here. Now, the thought in with prayer is that the intermediary is God in some way, in some form or some power, so that we pray to God or to some power, to intervene in some way or to influence in some way the outcome of whatever's happening over here. Now, in a way, it's sort of like, you know, the people that can make things move by thinking. I don't know if there's a term for that. And it's like extrasensory perception. There's a whole lot of things. Now, it involves a certain leap of faith to say that those things really can happen, and it's very hard to get any scientific evidence, and maybe these are things that you can't measure scientifically, that either you have to believe or you don't believe. But anyway, that's what we're talking about, intercessory prayer. So back in the 1800s, Sir Francis Galton looked at life expectancy of royal families, thinking that everybody prayed for the king. Everybody, you know, I mean, talk about who's being prayed for, the long live the king. So if you have all the thousands and hundreds of thousands of your subjects out there praying for you to live long, then you should live longer than the average person, right?
I mean, that's not sincere, was it?
Well, that's a good point. That gets a great point, because that's the whole question of all, how sincere was it? Anyway, but maybe they weren't sincere at all, and maybe they would say, long live the king, and may he die tomorrow. But anyway, they looked at life expectancy, and they turned out, although they were the most prayed for people in the kingdom, they had the shortest lifespan of all. Even when you corrected for the ones that were murdered, and there's always intrigue, you know, in the castle. So even correcting for that. So he then decided what he would do. He would look at it from that didn't work out. So he said, well, let's look at another thing. There were, back in the 1800s, there were slave boats traversing the Atlantic, and there were missionary boats, and they were following the same route. And the thought would be, well, clearly, on the missionary boats, you know, there's a lot of praying to God and people back home praying that they made it safely to the new world. So he looked, he went back into the records to find out whether there was any difference in the number of sinkings and crashes and anything else that happened on these things. And he went to Lloyd's of London. Lloyd's of London existed back then, and they insured these boats. And he came to the conclusion that if Lloyds had any idea that the missionary boats were going to be safer than the other boats, that they would, you know, that they would change their rates. And you know, these guys were smart, the actuaries back then. Turned out, Lloyds of London they had the records. There was no difference in the number of crashes or sinkings or disasters on board the ship. And the rates for insurance were the same, whether you were on a missionary boat or whether you were on a slave trader. So they couldn't develop any evidence at that point. Since that time, there wasn't a whole lot in the late 1800s or early 1900s, and then in the mid 1960s and 70s, there became a renewed interest, and there were a number of studies in which they would take a group of people who were sick, divide them in half, and then arrange to have people pray for half of them and not pray for the other half. And they did it with the rheumatoid arthritis, they did it with depression, they did it with patients in the intensive care unit, and couldn't find much difference. In 1988, there was a study by Bird at San Francisco General Hospital, where he went out and he got born-again Christians across the country to pray for half of the patients in the intensive care unit, and the other half didn't get prayed for. The half that got prayed for had fewer, lower incidence of cardiac arrest and had a lower number of days on ventilators. But the overall mortality and ultimate outcome was the same in the two groups. It was a fairly well-controlled study, best you can. But it gets down to you raised that question earlier about, you know, how sincere was the prayer, to try to organize this and get any thoughts, and then how do we know the people who weren't in the group that was getting the special prayers, that they didn't have family members that were praying for them as well? It gets extraordinarily, yeah.
And
extraordinarily
complicated.
Yeah,
does the patient know?
Right. In all these studies, the patients did not know.
They did not know.
The patients did not know. In some of the studies, the patients didn't even know that the study was going on. In some of the studies, they were told, are you willing to be enrolled in this study, knowing that you may or may not, sort of like a placebo versus getting the real thing. We may ask some people to pray for you, or we may not. What does that do to somebody, but they were willing to participate in the study.
Well, being an optimist, you would say that you are part of the prayer group.
Right.
So even if they were praying for you, if they were still feeling good about it,
So there have been these studies. The most recent one was one done at the Mayo Clinic. They looked at 799 patients in the coronary care unit. They got five people to pray for each individual. They divided in half, like 400 one group, 400 the other group. For the 400 they got prayed for, they had five people pray, and they went out and prayed for these people, and the balance for everything else in terms of the severity of illness. The people who did the praying, they were all religious people. They all had beliefs that they might have an influence. What they knew the patient's first name, they knew their age, they knew their sex, they knew what the diagnosis was, and they knew the general condition so that they could, pray for John or Jill or whoever it was, and they could say these prayers, and they would pray every day. When they analyzed all the data, there was no difference. That does not mean, this raises this whole question as I introduced this. So what does this mean? Can we really expect that we are going to make God intervene in some way by having a few people pray for it if God doesn't already know?
But the numbers of people that they had to pray for, I mean, this is almost...
You only had to pray for one person. There were five, so there were like a couple thousand intercessors. These are people who pray. But each one would pray just for one.
You just
prayed for one person.
Just prayed for one.
Right.
Okay, one-on-one.
With five people for each person.
No, yes, for each patient would have five people praying for them. So it didn't seem to have an impact, but it could be overwhelmed if you were not in the praying group, but you had a larger group of friends You had 10 people praying for you.
Right, yeah.
You know, and but it really does. It begs this question. It says, does God need to be reminded that someone is sick, or does he know, but he doesn't want to do anything about it unless someone else asks him to do it? I mean, it's like, should we even be asking these questions, or should we even be doing these studies? And so there's a lot of controversy in the medical literature where this is something that really is testable. Is religion just another form of aspirin, or is religion just another form of treatment? I'll get to it. Or is religion just another form of complementary medicine? Or is religion really something that is the way we exist in the world, that makes for a very different way of looking at this? Yeah.
There are, maybe not in studies, but I think individual doctors, perhaps all over the country or the world, can recite instances where they have no other explanation. I mean, this is also true too. There's no other explanation than that this child was prayed for and suddenly they're well, and there's no real medical explanation for it. I mean, there's also experiences like that all over. Is this not correct?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. We have seen things that can almost be referred to as miraculous miracles. But the fact that we don't understand what has happened doesn't mean that it's something that has violated the natural law. We can't say that. We just say we don't understand it right now, but it doesn't necessarily prove that it's a miracle, that it is something that has been with a divine intervention of some kind, which I think is the way you define a miracle. It's just something that things happen in ways that we don't quite understand. But that doesn't mean that it didn't follow the natural laws of the universe as we understand them. I think that's an important point. Yeah, Mary.
In Christianity, we believe that God hears our prayers and ask and you shall receive. And he hears us, and we're not asking him to do something that he doesn't know anything about. He knows. He knows every hair on your head, and he knows what happens to you every second of your life. So it's not a matter of a God sitting someplace over on the other side of the mountain, and you ring him up and say, "Hey, man, I got a problem." You know, yeah. But I think it's the intercessory thing that I know. I face the same dilemma too, but I've seen it work, and I've also seen groups working, praying for the wrong thing. And for instance, we had one of our president of our congregation was a very young man. He was in his early 30s. He had 4 children, and he was dying of cancer. I mean, it was inevitable that he was going to die because he was really, 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 really sick. And the congregation kept praying for his health, for his health, for his health, when it was obvious there wasn't, the medically speaking, there wasn't any help. And he died, okay? So everybody in the congregation went pits. You know, God doesn't answer prayer because he didn't hear us, and they didn't save this man. Well, I felt all along that we were praying for the wrong thing. We should have been praying for the strength for him to reach the end of his life, to pray for the strength of his family to walk through this, to pray for the strength of the congregation who were all attached to him, that we walk with him graciously to wherever he would go, whether it was health or whether it was death. So sometimes we get askew on what we're praying for. And I think that's another very variable that we don't look at.
And it's a question, do we really want to subject this to scientific testing?
It's impossible because it's right brain.
It's the wrong. We're trying to apply the wrong measures to it.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me ask you one question. What about these instantaneous healing at holy places like Lourdes that you read about? Do they really happen? Or, you know, people go to France and they go to these holy places. Supposedly are some miraculous healings. Do they really take place in a medical sense? Are the doctors there seeing these people before and after? Or
apparently.
How does that?
I can't answer that. I've been to Lourdes and I've seen the crutches hanging up on the wall that that people have you know, limped in and walked out. And it, has that happened? I suspect it has happened.
And it's maybe a mental.
But I suspect that it's extraordinarily rare, and I suspect that there are some explanations for those things. I guess I'm not a believer in divine intervention. I believe that we are part of this physical universe, and everything we do and everything we experience is part of the is part of the laws of nature, and that we can't get beyond that in this world. If there's another world, maybe we can. And so, is there an explanation for that? There probably is, and we don't know what it is.
Well, I was going to say that I thought that one of the problems with setting up the statistical analysis of intercessory prayer is that it takes prayer out of the community. And I say, you know, if the guy doesn't know that he's being prayed for and isn't part of the prayer, I think that it's less likely to work. And that's not to say I don't, I mean, I pray for my parishioners, but they know that I pray for them. And that's part of the healing of the community for them.
A good point. An excellent point. I again brings up that my own personal feeling is that we probably ought to leave religion where religion is and not try to medicalize it like we medicalize everything else.
The other thing I pray for the doctors.
Keep it up. We need all the help we can get to address the issue about the Lourdes. There's a grotto in Maryland, which is the Lady of Lourdes grotto, and people go there with serious illness. And there's an inscription there at the grotto, and I think this probably says it better than I could ever say it. For those who believe in God, no explanation is necessary. For those who do not believe in God, no explanation is possible. And that probably says it as well as you possibly can say, is that we're dealing with different belief systems, and you don't have to go there. You don't have to try. If God is working in your life or in the lives of your friends and your parish and your community, then why mess with it and try to document it and measure it and put numbers on it? Because it isn't, you're right, it isn't part of that, it doesn't lend itself to that. It's something that's very, very different. Well, in conclusion, I just want to read a quotation here from an article in the Archives of Internal Medicine on religion and medicine. We started off by saying that priest and physician were one and the same. We've separated. In some ways, we've shown that there. For a while, we didn't. I don't even think. Certainly, when I was going to medical school, we were really trained that they just weren't connected in any way. I mean, we were dealing with the physical, and the spiritual was to be kept totally separate. I think we have come a long way since then in recognizing that as individuals, and as patients, and as people, we have a spiritual side. I don't think that anybody is not spiritual in some way. That's there. It may not be in a formal religious way. But this quotation, I think, sort of said to me, certainly I feel comfortable with it. The priest and the physician are no longer one and the same person as they were in biblical times. However, the services each provides should complement and supplement each other for the benefit of the patient and the patient's total physical and mental well-being during health and illness and at the end of life. And so, if anything, it's a plea that we use in the hospitals, that we use the chaplains, and to me, the chaplain in my hospital has just been absolutely wonderful and extraordinarily useful. But we recognize that we have a spiritual side, that we have a religious side. Try not to let that either interfere or dominate when medicine needs to step in and to help, but also not to think that medicine has all the answers for all of life's problems. I'd be happy. I think it's at 10 o'clock. The bell's going to ring, and we ought to have a break. And thank you for sitting.